You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we interview Dr. Margaret Flowers about the New Hope Campaign, which stands for Health Over Profit for Everyone, and is working to make a national improved Medicare for All healthcare system the best, only, and most sane choice for ending the healthcare crisis.
The American College of Physicians Journal, their major journal, the Annals of Internal Medicine, for the first time in 90 years, put out a call for a national improved Medicare for All. The American Academy of Family Physicians and the American Academy of Pediatrics are now studying this as the solution to our healthcare crisis. And people in their local hospitals and clinics need to be also out there front and center calling for this. And we're seeing, you know, many health professionals standing up and speaking out at rallies around this.
Stood before you with her hands on her hips. She said, I'll accept love and loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be love.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe, Nidups and Nidabisks. Aguanu, I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land, in Bunawabskeg territory, where the sun is shining and the warmth seems to be returning after a very, very cold weekend. I'm located in and along the shores of the Penobscot River in central Maine, and I'm joined today by my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. You know that old saying, March comes in like a lion and out like a lamb? Well, the lion is roaring down the desert mesa today, and we have 30-mile-an-hour winds blustering around our house, which I'm sure you all will hear on the show today. We'll consider that our second guest for the day. But our primary guest is going to be someone you're familiar with, listeners, because we had Dr. Margaret Flowers on the show before, speaking about trade deals, and in particular, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which they were in the thick of trying to stop. Now, we got a little strangely lucky with that campaign, which is that Trump, for all of his many other shortcomings, and probably for the wrong reasons, just trounced the TPP and put it to a quiet death. So let's hope it stays there. We know a lot of other things like the KXL pipeline are returning from the dead to haunt us again. But what we're going to talk about with Margaret today is actually healthcare, a passion of hers that she has been working on for her whole life. Now, Dr. Margaret Flowers is also the co-founder of Popular Resistance, which is not just a news journal for resistance movements, but also organizes campaigns. And they have a new campaign around healthcare called HOPE. And HOPE stands for Health Over Profit for Everyone. You can look that up at healthoverprofitforeveryone.org. But we're going to let her tell you more about it and why this might be this unexpected moment to be able to push forward on healthcare despite all the seeming odds being stacked up against it.
Thank you for having me, Rivera and Sherry. I really appreciate it.
I'm really interested in, because we're going to have a lot to discuss and our time always runs out so quickly. So let's jump right in and let's talk about the HOPE campaign, how it came about, and some of the specific things that you're working on through the campaign.
Sure. Thank you very much. So it's actually healthoverprofit.org, but the acronym is Health Over Profit for Everyone. And that's because we believe that health should be the bottom line in our country, not profit. I'm glad you mentioned the TPP campaign because we're modeling this one very much off of the success of that. It's a national campaign singularly focused on winning a national improved Medicare for All and using and providing the tools to activists across the country so that they can educate themselves and others, organize actions, and pressure their members of Congress, just like we made the Trans-Pacific Partnership politically toxic so that all politicians were running away from it. We want to make national improved Medicare for all the only politically feasible solution.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the other solutions that they've come up with, because right now we have a situation in which the Republicans are yet again trying to overturn the ACA. This makes it something close to their 60th attempt. But they've introduced legislation for a new kind of health care. But this is worse than before. Instead of mostly privatizing the health care, they want to go all the way for privatizing the health care. Explain how this is different from what you're thinking about in terms of the national improved Medicare for all style of healthcare.
Sure, thank you. So as your listeners may be aware, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was a plan that was designed by the Republicans, passed by the Republicans in Massachusetts at the state level before it was brought to the national level under President Obama. And it was really based on a model that came out of the Heritage Foundation, which focuses on forcing people to purchase private insurance and then providing subsidies to help them do it. And it moved our system into a greater privatization of our health care. Now the Republicans are ready to take that all the way to its final conclusion, providing less resources for our public insurances like Medicare and Medicaid, and then providing lower cost, as they say, access to lower cost health insurance. But the way that our health insurance operates in the United States, it is a for-profit investor-owned institution that's first responsibility is to create profit. So the only way that they can lower costs is by making sure that they shift more of those costs onto individual patients or that they restrict coverage for services. So we'll be seeing if the Republicans succeed in putting forward their plan, what we'll see is more people maybe with insurance that doesn't really work for them, even worse than what we have right now under the Affordable Care Act, and less money, less public dollars to help people be able to afford that insurance. I could get more into the kind of the specific details, but it starts to get a little bit wonky at that point. If you want, I'm happy to break it down.
I think it's important because people don't really understand all of this. Even the president doesn't understand it. He just said, who knew healthcare could be so difficult, right? So let's break it down. Let's break it down
Sure.
for the people. I think it's really interesting that the Affordable Care Act was a Republican health care plan that they all supported initially. And then when Obama brought it into his platform, suddenly all of the Republicans were against it. And
Right.
so helping people to understand how much politics is playing into this, I think is important, but also helping people understand the nuts and bolts dynamics of how this is all working is really important.
Sure. And that was a really interesting thing during the fight in 2009, 2010, and even after that, was how much of this was really focused on politics and not at all about policy. What the Republicans are putting forward at this point is, you know, in the United States, we have public insurances like our Medicaid system, which is for people who are of lower income or who have disabilities, and then our Medicare, which is for people over 65 years of age, and that also covers some disabilities. And those are public insurances. Medicare is administered at the national level, Medicaid at the state level. And what the Republicans are planning to do with Medicaid is give the states just a set amount of money every year that they would get towards their Medicaid program. And that means that as their demand increases or prices are rising, they either have to cut back on how many people they can cover or what services they can cover. Whereas right now, it's a guaranteed benefit. The states define what they're going to provide, what you need to do to qualify, and then anybody who qualifies gets care under the Medicaid system if they sign up for it. Under Medicare, there's move towards pushing vouchers so that seniors would be given vouchers to go out into the market and purchase private health insurance, something that they haven't really had to do for a long time. And private insurers don't really like to pay for health care. Our seniors have some of our highest health care costs. So that means that, again, instead of having defined benefits and knowing that it's there for them, they'll be, you know, out there in the market trying to find whatever coverage they can afford. So that's not a good system. And then under the private insurance sector, Right now, we have a mandate that says if you don't qualify for a public insurance, you should buy a private insurance, or you are fined for not doing that. The private insurance is, there's a subsidy that the government provides to help people be able to afford that private insurance. What the Republicans are putting forward is saying that, well, we'll give you tax credits so that at tax time, you'll get some money back for the insurance that you paid for. Well, in this current environment where people are really struggling to make ends meet, those tax credits just don't work. And they've been proven not to work at the state level. So people just don't have the funds out of pocket to afford their health insurance and then wait to maybe get reimbursed for that at tax time. The other thing that they're moving towards is more of what are called health savings accounts. And this is where people can put money into a tax-free savings account that they can use to pay for health services when they need them. And again, this is something that is helpful for people who are wealthy, because it's a place where they can put money tax-free. But for the majority of people, they can't afford to even, you know, save up money to be able to put into a health savings account. And certainly that's not going to help them if they have a major problem like a major visit to the emergency room or major surgery. They're not going to be able to afford their deductibles. Most families have deductibles now that are $6,000 or $9,000. They're very high, and families just don't have that kind of money. So, and then the last thing that the Republicans are looking towards doing is selling insurance across state lines. And what this will really do is allow insurers to go to states that have the fewest regulations, create these really skimpy healthcare plans that they can then sell at a low cost. But when people need them, they'll find out that they really aren't working for them at all. So that's the basic outline of it.
I'm glad we broke that down, Margaret, because I do feel like those components are the things that confuse people and allow the wool to be pulled over their eyes, and why one of the reasons we run Love and Revolution Radio show as an hour-long program is to get into these details. So, you know, recently politicians across the country, largely either on the right but also some on the left, held town hall meetings in which they got put under heat about these proposed changes to healthcare and the national healthcare crisis that has been going on. We also just learned that this year, the average American family wealth went down between $17,000 and $35,000 in wealth. That there's a comparable statistic to income decreases as well. But as you said, like, the deductibles for the average family are just out of reach. So even if you have healthcare coverage, you're going broke, literally, trying to take care of your children, take care of yourself, take care of your health. And we do know that medical bankruptcy is the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States, and it's a major part of the debt burden that our nation is struggling under. One of the questions that I have is, at this juncture in time, are the Democrats fighting for healthcare for all, or are they in some weird gray land? I mean, we know the Republicans were fighting the ACA, and now they have their even worse nefarious deal on the table. But where are the Democrats in all this?
So this is a really interesting situation, and we have to remember that the Democrats are not supporters of a national improved Medicare for all. They've been pushed over and over when they're developing their platform to add a single-payer healthcare system in there, and they refuse. And back in 2009, 2010, when 80% of Democratic voters, like today, wanted a Medicare for all system, it was off the table for the Democrats, and instead they pushed forward this plan that really helped, you know, their funders, the health insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies and these for-profit hospital institutions. We did have two members of Congress. Congressman Conyers in the House, who's a Democrat from Michigan, has been a strong supporter of this and has introduced legislation called H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, every session since 2003. Currently, there are over 60 co-sponsors of that legislation. Now we'll get into what that means later. And then on the Senate side, Senator Sanders, Bernie Sanders, was our supporter of Improved Medicare for All, and in the past had introduced legislation. But this past November, after the election, he informed health advocates behind closed doors that he was not going to be introducing single-payer legislation during this term because he had to sacrifice that for Democratic Party unity was the excuse. And basically what that means is that overall, the Democratic Party is just going into a defensive mode. They just want to fight everything that the Republicans and the Trump administration put forward. And then they'll make a lot of promises about, well, if you reelect us, then we'll do all these great things. Of course, we've been down that road before and we see that that doesn't actually work. But we have been pressuring Senator Sanders to introduce legislation. People have been calling his office frequently, and we're starting to hear some movement that he is putting together legislation and that it will be more similar to the H.R. 676 plan than it was in the past. And that's been our specific ask is, the Republicans have a plan in the House and the Senate that's the same plan. We need to have the same plan in the House and Senate as well. And so people have been calling Senator Sanders and saying, introduce a companion bill to H.R. 676. And it's important that we continue to do that up until he puts it into, you know, drops the bill, because he needs to really hear it from people that that's what we want.
My question when I listen to all of this is, how do we actually secure something that's stable going forward when healthcare has become such a political issue that people really aren't concerned with what benefits the people? It's just really been about political posturing. And when we become the pawns of political posturing, which we have for a very long time now, become the pawns of political posturing, meaning the people on the ground who are impacted by all of this nonsense, how do we actually move something forward that has some type of stability that people can start counting on in their lives going forward? Because we're the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't provide single-payer health insurance. So how do we move this forward? Because politicians, we're talking about both Republicans and Democrats using this as a political tool. How do we, as the people, move this forward in a way that guarantees that we're going to have some stability in healthcare? Because I know that as a medical doctor, you've probably had your fair share of dealing with the insurance industry and all of these types of issues in your practice. So you're aware of how great a concern it is for people on the ground that are trying to be okay and trying to live their lives and be well.
Right. And that's what actually, you know, made me leave medical practice, was just how our system is not about health for people. There was, you know, in 2009, 2010, I served as a congressional fellow for Physicians for National Health Program. This is a national organization of now about 20,000 members who advocate for a national improved Medicare for all. And the lesson that I learned out of that experience, and it was interesting, it falls into the acronym of ICU. So I often say that we're in a health crisis and we need ICU or intensive care unit. But in this circumstance, the I stands for independence. It's really important that we as individuals don't tie the solution that we advocate for to the agenda of a particular, you know, Democrat or Republican political party, because that's what happened under the Obamacare legislation, is that people said, oh, well, this is Obama's legacy and we have to support it, even though it's gotten weaker and weaker and it wasn't that great to begin with. And now it really stinks. But, you know, this is what we have to do for the Democrats. So that's what I stands for, is independence. And then C stands for clarity, because the messaging that was out there was that the Affordable Care Act was going to be universal, guaranteed, and affordable. And we knew that it was never going to be any of those things. But the public was fed that over and over again. Members of Congress had that as their talking points. And so people were fooled by that. We have to understand what works and what doesn't work at the policy level. And unfortunately, National Improved Medicare for All is really simple for people to understand. And then the third thing, U stands for uncompromising. And that means that we have to see that moving to a national improved Medicare for all is the lowest, you know, it's the least step that we can take, the smallest incremental step to change the whole dynamic so that our health system is about health and not about profit. And we have to be uncompromising in that demand, because anything less is not going to move us in the direction we need to go. And that works. I mean, we saw that in our fight to try to reclassify the internet as a common carrier. We went up against these giant telecommunications industries, which are some of the biggest lobbyists in D.C., who wanted to further privatize and control and monetize the internet. And we were told that what we wanted, reclassifying it as a common carrier, was off the table. And the allies that we worked with, many of them didn't believe that we could put it on the table. And we did through strategic, you know, actions and then developing public pressure. Over 4 million people commented to the FCC, the majority of them saying that was what they wanted. And we continued to escalate. The FCC started to compromise. Some of our allies said, well, we'll just try to make that the best compromise. And we said, no, we have to hold firm. We did. We escalated our tactics and we won that. And I think that's a very instructive fight in terms of what we need to do to win these battles.
Well, it's a great campaign to bring up because the telecommunications industry is a massive industry, but the healthcare industry is even larger. I mean, we hear a lot of discussion about the military budget in this country, and it is obscene to have over 50% of your tax dollars going directly to the military. But what people don't realize is that the military-industrial complex is actually quite small compared to the medical-industrial complex, which I believe makes up something close to 25% of the gross national product. Now, that's a little bit sickening in and of itself, that a quarter of our economy is based on what is essentially an illness system. It's not about care, it's about profiting off of our sicknesses. And while this is all going on, we have 80 American citizens each day dying from lack of access to healthcare. That's something I learned off of your Hope website. Now, If this was in a war, if we had 80 civilians being killed, we can only imagine the kind of outcry that our warmongers would be able to raise up out of us. But here we have 80 people each day dying of lack of access to healthcare, and where is that outcry from our politicians? Now, if they're digging in their heels and they're not going in a direction anywhere good for the people on healthcare, is there hope in other arenas for the types of resistance that may build up that public pressure? I mean, what about in the healthcare industry itself with nurses and doctors and healthcare practitioners? What about in citizen organizing? What about in the home care industry? Are we seeing any signs of organized resistance to demand this single-payer universal health care for all?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. We're in a really interesting moment because I've been doing this work for a long time, and I frequently give what's called a grand rounds lecture at hospitals. It's a continuing medical education lecture that hospitals have to have, and they invite me to come and speak about this topic. And over the 10 or so years that I've been doing that, I've seen an increasing level of desperation from the medical student level all the way up to the chairs of the departments and their frustration with the current system and their desperate desire to have a system like this. And the stories I hear are just, even from department chairs, are just outrageous of how the insurance companies flat out refuse to pay them for services until they're desperate and they're willing to take a deal that isn't even, you know, what they need. So I think increasingly in the medical profession, we're seeing support for this. The nurses, the largest nurses union, National Nurses United, supports this. We see religious institutions that have come out in favor of this, labor unions, and then lots of community groups. And what's interesting right now is that we're hearing from organizations where this is not their primary issue, but they're coming and saying, we think this is the most important thing that we should be fighting for right now. They see how this change to treating healthcare as a public good instead of a commodity is an essential struggle, because this is kind of the common thing that we see in so many areas where things are commodified instead of treated as something that we all need and we should all have access to, like education and housing and transportation, reliable transportation, clean energy. So it's a very fundamental fight. And these healthcare town halls that are going on right now, I've been invited to speak at some of them, even in, you know, kind of very conservative districts. And each one of them is turned into a discussion about how we get national improved Medicare for all. And even the people who are on the panel that are there to defend the Affordable Care Act tell me, well, this is what I really want. I just didn't think that we could get it. So the public is moving there. Even Republicans, a very new poll that was done, I think just last month, showed a 20% increase in two different sectors of Republican voters, economic sectors. So people who earn under $25,000 and people who earn between $25,000 and $75,000 increased their support for this solution by 20%. The lowest income people support it at 52%, and then the next group at 34%. So this is like, I think people are recognizing that we can't make the current system that we have work, and that we have to go to something that's been proven to work here through our traditional Medicare and all around the world.
The numbers on this are really staggering when you do the breakdown on the numbers. When I was looking at some of the stuff on the website, one of the things that is so shocking to me is that the U.S. spends 17.4% of its gross domestic product on healthcare expenditures, which is the largest by a wide margin. The average of the 34 other countries who are part of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the world's most advanced capitalist countries in the world, 34 of them, the average is roughly 9.5%. And the U.S. spends 17.4%. And trillions of dollars above what it would normally spend, because the healthcare system is designed for private profit rather than public health. So getting healthcare providers on board, I think, is important. But how do we address this overall structure, the larger structure of how healthcare is designed for the sake of profit? Because that really seems like the underlying problem. Like, we can come up with all of these solutions, but if we don't address the underlying problem that our healthcare system is not designed to meet the needs of public health, but is designed for private profit, then we're never going to be able to solve these problems, because they're going to continue to look for ways to profit off from the people that are sick and dying.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. That's why we support this solution, because the legislation basically would get rid of private health insurance. That industry would go away, and we would all pay in through a progressive tax into a system, a single payer financing system for a national health insurance. And then it would be there for everyone. No out-of-pocket costs like premiums, copays, or deductibles. Hospitals would get a regular monthly check to take care of their population. And so they're not competing with each other to make the most profit. They're just getting money to provide care. They don't have to keep track of every little thing that they do. It's amazing how much time nurses spend just keeping track of each aspirin that was given, each, you know, little pair of shoes that people are given, or every little thing. And they don't want to be doing that. They would much rather be actually providing direct care to their patients. And so this is why we say that this is the smallest step, is to get rid of that profit motive. And then from there, it gives us a system where the bottom line is health. And there's going to be a lot more to do, because we've had the system now for a number of decades. And so it is going to take public pressure to really push for a health system that is about health. It gives us a greater opportunity to push for public policy that supports public health. We see in countries that have these types of systems that they know that if they put toxins into the food, into consumer products that pollute the environment, that those are going to have greater health costs, and they don't want to pay those. So if you look at, like, the European Union, for example, they're much more conscious about making sure that products are safe and that they're not doing things that are harming the public health.
I just want to ask a quick follow-up question, because one of the things that I hear all the time when I talk to people about this is that the U.S. is subsidizing the healthcare of other countries with their inflated costs. Can you address that question?
That we're subsidizing the healthcare in other countries.
Yeah. What people are saying essentially is that with the inflated healthcare costs in this country, certainly related to pharmaceuticals, that the pharmaceutical industry is then able to offer lower healthcare costs to other countries. Therefore, the U.S. is somehow subsidizing the healthcare costs of other countries that have single-payer systems, so that their numbers aren't really accurate.
That's a really interesting idea. I've not actually heard that one. I keep hearing new ones all the time.
And we'll be back to hear the response from Dr. Margaret Flowers to Sherry's question after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly Nonviolence Minute. On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to take a look at a piece of nonviolent history that happened this week, years ago. The text for this piece comes largely from the website www.historybyzim.com. On Monday, March 12, 1990, disability rights activists descended on the U.S. Capitol demanding the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, which would give equal rights to people with disabilities. The ADA had been passed by the Senate the year before, but was getting bogged down in the House of Representatives. On this day, over 1,000 protesters came from 30 states to protest the act's delay. After the day's rally and speeches, over 60 activists abandoned their wheelchairs and mobility devices and began to crawl up the 83 stone steps that led up to the Capitol building. During this time, people were loudly chanting, "What do we want? ADA. When do we want it? Now." Other activists remained at the bottom holding signs and giving encouragement to the crawlers. "I want my civil rights," Paulette Patterson of Chicago stated as she was inching her way to the top. "I want to be treated like a human being." 8-year-old Jennifer Keelan, a second grader from Denver suffering from cerebral palsy, was famously videotaped while crawling up the stairs. "I'll take all night if I have to," she firmly stated. The ADA had 4 goals for people with disabilities: equal opportunity, full participation, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency. On July 26, 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law by President George H. Bush. On signing the measure, Bush said, "Let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down." The Capitol crawl had an effect on the passage of the ADA. Several senators felt that the stunt pushed them to approve the act. To present-day disability activists, the Capitol crawl is seen as one of the single most important events that finally pushed for the passage of the ADA into law. In addition to being an intriguing bit of nonviolent history, the multi-pronged and long-lasting campaign for the Americans with Disabilities Act is also a great example of how perseverance, organizing, and determination can help us secure basic human rights for everyone. On this week's show, as we look at the challenges that lie ahead in securing universal single-payer health care for all, this story that took place this week in nonviolent history can stand as an example for us all. And now let's return to our program to hear that fascinating answer from Dr. Margaret Flowers about whether or not the U.S.'s inflated healthcare costs are subsidizing countries that have universal single-payer systems.
So other countries have lower pharmaceutical and health service costs because they have a system that actually negotiates a fair price with those pharmaceutical and health delivery companies. And they still make a profit, but it's a reasonable profit, not the outrageous profit. In the United States, we have no rational system for determining the price of medications or the price of healthcare. There have been studies that have looked at this, and it's widely varied in terms of the cost of health services, no rhyme or reason to that. And then when it comes to the pharmaceutical companies, their prices are not related to the cost of production or research and development. And we've seen that most starkly in, you know, recently. There were a couple of instances that became very public, but the one that I think is the most stark was the one around the EpiPen. Epinephrine pens are something that people who have severe allergies, such as a food allergy, carry with them so that if they are exposed, they can give themselves an injection and try to hold off the reaction until they can get medical help. And so that's a life-saving thing that people carry with them. And the pharmaceutical company that owned that raised the price from, I think it was around $25 for a 2-pack when I was in practice, to $600. Again, it cost about $1.50 to make that. So it had no rhyme or reason. So I don't think that we're subsidizing the cost of these in other countries. I think we're just helping to pad those pharmaceutical company profits, which is what their bottom line really is.
One of the things I know you do a lot, Margaret, is myth busting around this issue. And I'm wondering if there's other commonly stated myths or beliefs that people bring up over and over again that deserve to be punctured with a little bit of truth. Are there a few that come to mind?
Sure, thanks. One of the main ones is the myth that, oh, if we go to a national improved Medicare for all system, we'll have rationing. And I think what people don't recognize often is that in the United States, we already have rationing of healthcare, but we do it in the cruelest way that we can possibly do it. We do it based on one's ability to pay. So, you know, if we look at other countries that have these systems, when it comes to access to emergency or acute care services, everybody has access to those. That's not a problem. When it comes to things that can wait, sometimes there are wait lines for people to get into. But in the United States, with our 29 million people who have no health insurance at all, and then tens of millions of more people who have purchased health insurance, but they don't have the money out of pocket to meet the copays and deductibles, they don't even have a way to get in line to get to care. So this would really end that cruel form of rationing. And what we see in countries that adopt these systems is that those who have been had their health needs unmet are then able to get the care they need. And people who may have overused the system, there are a small portion of people that do that, then they may have to wait or they may not get something, but in general, then it's something that they didn't really need. You know, and Sherry brought up the point earlier about the spending in the United States. We spend 2 times more per person per year on healthcare than most other industrialized nations, and they cover everyone. They have longer life expectancies and better health outcomes. So we're already paying for this system, but because of the great administrative waste and the profits and CEO salaries of those who are profiteering off of the system, we're just spending a lot of money that doesn't actually go to care. I guess another big one is concern about innovation. People say, oh, well, we won't have innovation if we go to one of these systems. That isn't true. You know, if we look at other countries, they still have medical innovation. I think it would actually create a system where we have a better form of innovation, because right now, pharmaceutical companies, medical device companies, they come up with something. They don't have to prove that it's better than what we currently have, and so they market it. And it's not always something that is better or that we even actually need. If we create a health system where the bottom line is health, we can start to define, oh, here are areas where we need research, where we need something that meets this need, and that's what we're going to pay for if a company develops that. So I think it will drive a better innovation. And then finally, the last one is competition. People often say, well, we have to have competition between our health insurances, and then that will just bring the prices down and make them better. But health insurance companies compete to cover the healthiest patients and to be able to charge as much as they can. So that's kind of opposite of what we actually need. Under a single-payer healthcare system, the competition comes between health professionals, who's providing good service, because suddenly everyone can go where they want to go. You get to choose. You no longer have an insurance company saying that you can only go to this place or that place or this doctor or this nurse. And so now practices and hospitals will have to compete to attract people based on the quality of services that they provide.
I think that it's just so disappointing that people aren't able to look at this with the type of common sense required to be able to solve the problem. We look at other countries like Germany, France, the British healthcare system, Canadian healthcare system. Under those systems, everyone is covered. In the United States, we have 51 million people who are not covered. And so, like you said, you know, the money is being spent in other areas. It's just not being spent efficiently. It's being spent to line the pockets of those who are profiting off from the healthcare industry. And so what about this concept that the U.S. healthcare system is based on a family wage instead of a social wage, unlike other countries where, you know, healthcare is a right?
Right.
In the U.S., healthcare is a privilege. And so the large disparities that exist in the ability of people to be able to access healthcare in this country actually becomes a real moral issue.
Absolutely. I mean, in other countries, they treat care, healthcare as a human right or something that's in the public interest. And so part of that is understanding that one of the principles of that is equity, that, you know, not everybody has the same means. And so the system has to make sure that each person is able to get, you know, access to the care that they need, you know, no matter where they are socioeconomically, where they are geographically. And so these are systems that are actually designed to make sure that people have access to care. The United States has one of the most regressive financing systems in the world. I think we're ranked 54th in the fairness of our financing. And that means that people at the lower end of the income spectrum have to pay a much higher percentage of their income on healthcare than those at the top. And so that means that people are just not getting care. That's something we see in the United States that is a much more of a problem than you see anywhere else, so that people just delay or deny, you know, or don't get care because they can't afford it, and they end up risking a worse condition that will cost more to take care of or have a worse outcome, maybe leaving them disabled as a result. That just doesn't happen elsewhere. So when we put together H.R. 676, Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, a few years ago, we had a health economist look at how we could finance that in the U.S. and come up with a progressive method of financing. And if we were to use that financing method, people who earn less than 40% of the income would only pay a 3% tax. That's if you're paying taxes. And then people who make in the top 60% bracket would pay a 6% tax. And if you think of families right now where the average family cost of just health insurance alone is about $17,000 a year, that gets way up into the, you know, 10-15% range of people's income. And so this would be really a significant savings for people. And then that actually creates kind of an economic stimulus. And we have studies that have looked at this as well, as how moving to this type of system means that people have more discretionary income, then they're able to spend that on things that they need, and that becomes a job stimulus as well.
What are the next tangible steps forward? I mean, there must be one prong of pressuring politicians, but we know that from the Gillen's Page study or the Princeton Oligarchy study that they're going to listen to rich people or businesses. And in this case, one of the largest business sectors is not going to be advocating for this necessarily. So what might be the strategies for actually mobilizing other businesses? In your FCC campaign, you successfully mobilized 200-plus mid- to large-size tech industry companies to also put pressure on the FCC to make the right choice. Is there a comparable strategy in this case? And if this whole route fails or doesn't work, are there other means and tactics of civil resistance to actually put pressure upon the current healthcare system to really break through to the other side of what we actually need?
Sure. Great question. So, you know, we are working now to change the political culture so that over the next few years, National Improved Medicare for All becomes the only politically feasible solution that our politicians are able to act on. And so there are a number of ways that we do that. You know, we start out education, organizing people, mobilizing them, creating a movement of movements, because this really impacts everything, and over time escalating our actions. And I think that we have to take a page from what we're seeing from other movements that are trying to change large corporations, like the climate justice movement, where people are going and calling for divestment, obstructing offices, shutting them down. And we used some of those tactics in 2009, 2010. There was a divestment movement that began where religious institutions were starting to divest their funds from health insurance, private health insurance corporations. And so I think we could continue to encourage pension funds and others to divest from them. We had national days of mobilization where we went to private insurance companies and blockaded them, shut them down. Actually, in Louisville, Kentucky, there was a group of people who ended up being locked inside the lobby of Humana all night long without access to water or bathrooms. They didn't expect that to happen. And then pressuring our members of Congress, bird-dogging them, going to their offices and pressuring them there. These are all things that we need to be doing. It's interesting that you brought up businesses, because one of the kind of tactics that we're looking at now is to bring some major businesses, business groups, particularly small and medium-sized businesses, which really are hurt by healthcare costs in this country, to write a letter to President Trump, a businessman, about why a national improved Medicare for All system would be so beneficial for our businesses and even for our larger international businesses, because other countries don't have these high healthcare costs. So it really is a drag on our larger corporations as well. And there's a movie that came out, I think it was a year ago, by a businessman called Fix It. And it lays out a case for why businesses should be supporting the solution. So these are some of the things that we're working on and will be working on in this campaign.
I want to give our listeners an opportunity to learn more. So can you talk a little bit about some of the tools for education that are found on the Health Over Profit website and how people might be able to use those tools to start educating people in their own communities?
Sure, thank you. The Health Over Profit website was really designed as a site for people, and we'll be continuing to add new things to it as people ask for them or as we are able to do that. But it has various tool pages. So if you're interested in knowing how do you write a letter to the editor, that's a great way to reach people in your community with this message. We have a page under Tools for Media that shows you how to do that, how to find the papers, what are the requirements for letters that they need. We have tools that talk about how you use social media, Facebook and Twitter, and some memes that people can, you know, images that people can copy and paste and use. In those aspects, we have Tools for Action page that tells people how you contact your member of Congress, how do you bird dog them, what are some creative actions that you can use to pressure them, how do you reach the public through visibility actions, teach-ins, and those types of things, and how do you, you know, shut down or, you know, do direct action against these corporations that are profiteering off of our current system. And then we have a Tools for Education page that we're continuing to fill out with resources so that people can learn themselves and then also share that knowledge. Physicians for National Health Program, I continue to be an advisor to the board, to that organization, has chapters across the country. And so they have a whole speakers bureau. If people want to do a community event, a type of teach-in or any kind of, you know, public panel or anything, they can reach out to Physicians for National Health Program to find local speakers. Oh, and one other thing, we're doing regular calls every other Monday. We do a national education call where we also give a political update and talk about our actions that are being organized.
Wow. Well, that's great that you guys have so many resources for people there. And the average American cares about this because it's up close and personal. It's in their families. It's in their friends. It's in their neighborhoods. If they are a small business employer, this issue is right in the heart of how they're trying to run their business and provide health care and keep their workers healthy. I mean, it's really something that affects us all. I think sometimes people feel like getting from point A to point B on this issue is an insurmountable obstacle. But you make it sound like, yeah, it's a pretty big mountain. But if we start taking the right steps in the right directions, eventually we're going to get over the hurdle. Will you speak a little bit about just what is the journey? You've said that you're looking ahead several years on this. Do we see this being an escalating issue in the Trump administration? Are we biding our time while preparing the grounds for more favorable political conditions? I mean, how does this relate to the current problems that we're facing on the political level?
Short answer is that no, we are not biding our time, that we know that whichever plutocratic party is in power, Democrats or Republicans, this issue is not on the table. And it's up to us as people to organize, put it on the table, and then fight for it to win it. And it really is about people understanding that we have the power to do this. This is how major social transformation has always occurred throughout time in our country and other countries, by people educating themselves, organizing in their communities, and mobilizing to take action, focusing on those targets that will give them success. I guess, you know, for me, my journey has really been about how does this happen? Because we have, on so many issues in this country, super majorities of people who support positions or policies that our government is going in the opposite direction on. You know, people want a strong, high-quality public education. They want affordable housing. They want a rapid transition to a clean environment. They want to scale down our military and stop being such an aggressor in the world. And so when we recognize that we have the power, when we organize to make this change, then it really changes the whole mindset. And we don't always win. I mean, we look at the Dakota Access Pipeline fight, a tremendous fight, and it's not over yet. It's this is a fight of many kind of battles. I hate to use war terminology, but we're going to keep going and going and going and persisting because that's how we ultimately do win these fights. And I just feel very optimistic right now because of what I'm seeing out in the community all across the nation, what I'm hearing at these town halls and getting feedback from other people that, you know, this really is the time. We'll be running, encouraging people to run in 2018 and 2020 on this platform. And just as we made the Trans-Pacific Partnership politically toxic because people were really out there loudly at every event with their member of Congress holding up signs. People may remember even at the DNC convention in Philadelphia, people had all kinds of people in there had anti-TPP signs, even making people who had been supportive of it, like Hillary Clinton, but even some Republicans like Rob Portman, who was a Republican senator who was on the Senate Finance Committee and had been a U.S. trade rep. He had to switch his position because his constituents were there. So it's kind of, you know, when the people lead, ultimately the leaders will follow.
I think that's so important for people to remember that we are empowered to be able to actually create change, that we feel often powerless under these massive systems. But we have to remember that they're designed to represent us and that if we move in a different direction and withdraw our support through divestiture and a number of other strategies, then that those institutions will have to follow the will of the people. That's something that I'm always talking about in the work that I do. And I think that it's really critical for people to understand that because there are so many issues right now that people are facing that are very critical. I've been referring to it as like scattershot, getting people to run in all different directions so that there's all of this maneuvering that's going on under the surface that is not serving the needs or the will of the people. And, you know, we need to take back our power within our own democracy in order to be able to continue to move things forward in a direction that sustains life.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this, because this has at its core, the issue that we're facing in so many areas, that as we organize around this and educate ourselves and start to change the political culture, I think we're going to see transformation in other areas of our lives as well. And I know you asked earlier about, you know, what can people do in their communities? I mean, we're facing a real healthcare crisis. And, you know, I know that people are also can apply pressure locally. You know, people who are health professionals need to start coming out more strongly and saying, you know, advocating for this position. We're seeing movement in that direction. In fact, the American College of Physicians journal, their major journal, the Annals of Internal Medicine, for the first time in 90 years, put out a call for a national improved Medicare for all. The American Academy of Family Physicians and the American Academy of Pediatrics are now studying this as the solution to our healthcare crisis. And people in their local hospitals and clinics need to be also out there front and center calling for this. And we're seeing, you know, many health professionals standing up and speaking out at rallies around this. So I think that, and also just kind of finding ways that we can start to provide mutual support in our communities as well and say, look, you know, while we're fixing this, let's understand that healthcare is a human right and that we need to work together to take care of each other. And let's start to change that political culture as well.
Margaret, as a healthcare professional and as a movement organizer and as a human being with a beautiful, warm heart, I'm wondering if in the closing of our show, you would send a message to those who are facing cuts to their coverage in healthcare, because some people are really at that crossroads that they need access and they're not getting it, or someone who is struggling with an illness and can't get access to healthcare. Is there any words of encouragement or of the heart that you might want to send towards them today?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, it really, this is one of the reasons that keeps me fighting this fight is because there is such suffering and preventable deaths in this country that don't have to be that way. And that's, we have to keep that front and center as we're fighting for this. And also just know that there are a majority of people in the country who want the solution. And also that you're not alone in the situation that you're experiencing, that so many people in the United States are experiencing this, and that it's so often people are told, well, it's your fault. You didn't get insurance when you should have. You didn't work hard enough. You didn't earn enough money. And we can't accept that. We have to understand that this is a system. It's intentional. It was created by human beings, and it was created for the wrong reason, to make profits for corporations. And we as human beings can also intentionally create a system that supports us, that supports human life. It's what the majority of health professionals that I run into want to see anyway. And also, don't feel alone, and also reach out in your community, because a number of times there have been fights, and I've been involved in some, where an insurance company denies care or a person is denied care, and people in that community organize and rally around that person and are able to put on the pressure and sometimes win the care that that person needs. So don't feel ashamed. It's not you, it's the system, and reach out for help in your community.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much for joining us today. And can you give our listeners a heads up on where they can find the information, on what is the address for the website or any other social media sites that people can refer to get more information on this?
Thank you. The website is healthoverprofit.org. We're on Facebook at Health Over Profit for Everyone. And the Twitter, if you can imagine, Hope was a very widely used Twitter handle. So it's at HOPE4E. But you can also find that on our website, healthoverprofit.org. We're organizing now around an International Day of Action, April 7th. It's against the privatization of healthcare. It's called Our Health is Not for Sale. And you can find more information about that on the action page of the website, and find information about our regular phone calls, national phone calls, under the news section.
Thank you so much, Margaret, for the work that you're doing and for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Margaret Flowers, for discussing the critical issues surrounding healthcare with us today. And I'd like to thank my co-host, Rivera Sun, for helping bring these engaging conversations to the airwaves with me every week. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to you, Sherry Mitchell, for deepening the conversation and whipping out those great statistics mid-show about pharmaceuticals. If you're looking for more of Sherry's wisdom and thoughts and reflections, you should check out her Sacred Instructions Facebook page, the link to which can be found on the Love and Revolution page and on the podcast notes. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. Today, Margaret Flowers outlined the critical need of addressing the national healthcare crisis, which has been caused by our healthcare being designed for private profit rather than the public health. This has resulted in a healthcare system that does more to harm the public than it does to support it. Despite the fear tactics used to keep the healthcare industry profitable for the few, we actually know that the myths related to costs for a single-payer system are all a fallacy. The money needed to sustain a single-payer system is already available to us. It's just being spent on inflated CEO salaries, inflated pharmaceutical costs, and high administrative costs of for-profit HMOs. If we want to create a healthcare system that meets the needs of us all, we have to all get involved. The first step in that involvement is educating ourselves about the problem. So, listeners, perhaps you'll take the time to visit the Health Over Profit page and educate yourself a bit more deeply on the benefits and savings associated with a single-payer system by the time we talk to you next week.
What if you knew that your actions could turn by